Welcome to the UFO Files. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting direct from Las Vegas at the Sunset Station Hotel and Casino, where the Crash Retrieval Conference is going on. It's been going on for a while here, dealing with UFO crashes and reports over the years. Lots of interesting things coming out on the crash retrieval situation that we'll probably try to get into a little bit. Stanton Friedman is our guest this hour. He'll be along here in a few minutes. Stanton, of course, well-known for the MJ-12 documents and his book on the subject, and one of the top-notch researchers in the field of UFO crashes. So it promises to be a very, very interesting program. I guess it's been about 25 years since Stanton started his investigation into the whole situation. And it's an interesting thing. And Stanton told me one time about how he got into that. And actually, it didn't happen in Roswell, New Mexico originally. Ran across Jesse Marcel there in Louisiana, of all places. I went to Roswell, started researching it. Came up with, the reputation of being one of the top experts of the Roswell crash and what happened and what didn't happen. And then he kind of explored some of the other things that were involved as well. Really, I think you'll enjoy the conversation that we'll have with Stanton here in a moment. Now, the MJ-12 documents have been really a big subject for some time, and a lot of people have been wondering about whether or not they're real. Lots of different kinds of copies around. Stanton's been on documentaries, he's been on TV programs, has a book or two. Some people have really gone after Stanton and tried to attack him on his MJ-12 stories. Unfortunately, the critics almost always follow the four basic rules of debunkers, and we'll have Stanton get into that in the interview, because not only is it clever, but it also makes a lot of sense. So stand by. We're going to be talking to Stanton Friedman here in a moment as we get ready for our show. Hope you stay tuned. Don't go away. This is Jerry Pippin, and this, of course, is our broadcast from Las Vegas on the UFO Files.
Internationally acclaimed private eye Joe Culligan has a new book or video that may answer these questions. How much alimony does he pay? How much child support does he pay? Did he really graduate from college? What assets does he own? Does his divorce file say he beat his wife? Is he all he claims to be? Has he ever been arrested? Does he have a history of drunken driving? And much, much more. Before you agree to marry anybody, before you take on a new business partner, before you begin any serious relationship, don't put yourself in danger. Order P.I. Joe Culligan's When in Doubt, Check Him Out. The book or video is just $19.95 plus postage. Ship anywhere you wish. To anyone you care about. We'll ship confidentially. To order by credit card, call now 1-800-921-9898. That's 1-800-921-9898. Specify the book, the video, or both. Don't risk your business or your life. Call 1-800-921-9898 now.
And we have Stanton Friedman, who's a legend in UFO land. For sure, Stanton, I heard some great things about your trip to Table Rock on Thursday.
That was fun. I enjoyed myself.
And you, of course, will be speaking here at this conference as well. And this conference really is probably pretty dear to your heart simply because of the subject matter.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've been working on crash flying saucers, or working about them. I haven't been on any crash flying saucers for more than 25 years. And, you know, it's kind of funny. I'm giving the same, well, the same title for the talk, and Table Rock, New Attacks on Roswell and MJ-12, and I'm doing that here. But I had 2 hours to speak there, and I only have 45 minutes here. So I'm going to be talking very, very rapidly.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can cover some of the things that you're not going to be able to cover here, too. I know that we have talked about this in the past, and your book is just incredible. And before we go any further, let's talk about your latest project. So you got a new book out or anything?
I don't have a new book out. I've got one outline. I've got a couple chapters done, Flying Saucers and Science. And I'll try to, I've done about 75 papers on UFOs over the years, a lot of MUFON conference papers and little articles and stuff. And the idea is to update the papers, because I cover a lot of subjects that nobody else really covers. Travel to the stars from somebody who's worked on fission and fusion rockets and stuff like that.
I like that already.
Well, I'm pointing out the errors in the way of those astronomers who think that they can say it's impossible, when we have a past history of their saying that's impossible about things that we now know are possible. For example, a great astronomer in 1903, October, just over 100 years ago, published an article in which he considered the future of flight. The only way man would ever fly, he said, would be with the help of a balloon, 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. And when he found out about that, he said, well, maybe a pilot, but certainly they'll never carry any passengers. 20 years later, another great astronomer, Dr. Bickerton, proved that it would be impossible to give anything sufficient energy to get it into orbit around the Earth. He said, look, here's our finest explosive. Here's the amount of energy it takes per pound of stuff that you want to put in orbit when it's moving 18,000 miles an hour. Here's the amount of energy per pound of explosive. It's short by a factor of 10. He made two bad mistakes. One, they're better, more dense energy content of rocket propellants, the right ones, than an explosive, which are rather messy, obviously, if you want to build a rocket with them. And secondly, you don't want to put the rocket fuel in orbit. You want to put the payload in orbit. What he showed was it would take 10 pounds of propellant to put 1 pound of payload in orbit. My favorite, though, because I live in Canada and I'm a dual citizen, I complain about both governments pretty equally. Dr. Campbell in 1941 was tired of all this science fiction crap about taking a man to the moon. He was going to show that that was nonsense. Published a long scientific paper trying to figure out what would be the required initial launch weight of a chemical rocket able to get a man to the moon and back. Now, that's a legitimate question. How big does the darn thing have to be? And pages of equations. Bottom line, it would have to weigh 1,000,000 tons. Now, fast forward 30 years, less than 30 years, and we get three guys to the moon and back. Initial launch weight of the rocket was all of 3,000 tons. He was off by a factor of 300 million. So when astronomers do calculations about space travel, they are almost invariably astronomically in error. Why? Not that they're stupid. It's because it's something about which they are ignorant. They don't know about aeronautics, astronautics, that kind of thing. Incidentally, some of the silly assumptions he made were that you'd use a single-stage rocket. And of course, we don't use single-stage rockets. He assumed a limit of 1G acceleration, and our astronauts have to take several G's. As a matter of fact, I was just over at a display of the Liberty 7 spacecraft, which was recovered from the bottom of the ocean. That was one Gus Grissom was in. They got him out, but the spacecraft went down, you know. And there's information at that same facility, Science Center up in Kansas City, that one of the astronauts in testing work had taken 16 G's, and another one had taken 20 G's, and Dr. Campbell assumed a limit of 1 G. He also assumed something that a lot of people don't think about, that the rocket has to provide all the energy for the trip. But we use cosmic freeloading. I don't know if anybody's heard of cosmic freeloading, but
Let's talk about that for a minute. I like the term.
Well, when we launch, there's several things you note. One, we launch from near the equator, Cape Canaveral. We try to get about as far south as you can get. And we launch to the east. Why? Because the Earth rotates at about 1,000 miles an hour at the equator. That's a freebie. Second freebie is we launch it so that if the moon didn't come along, it would come right back. Fortunately, the moon's rather regular in its path around the Earth. Why not let its gravitational field pull you in? Why should you provide the energy? Third, when we come back, Dr. Campbell assumed you had to fire a retro rocket. But every pound of propellant you use at the end had to be launched from the Earth at the beginning, slowed down at the moon, takes propellant to do it each step of the way, launched from the moon and slowed down back here. What do? We say, thank you, God, for giving us an atmosphere, gives us something to breathe, and we can slow down the rocket by being smart instead of powerful. Apollo 13, the story, you know, you come in at the correct angle. If you miss that, you either dig a hole in the ground or you miss the planet. So you put all these things together, and you say that the people who say you can't get here from there don't know what they're talking about. It's like saying, how can you have a powerful computer on your desk? Look at these vacuum tubes. Look how much energy they produce. Sorry, we're not using vacuum tubes anymore.
I think I get your point about the whole thing, Stanton. You have a wonderful knack of breaking it down so we can all understand it.
I hope so. I mean, my feeling is I'm trying to reach the world. I'm not trying to preach to the converted, and I'm not trying to impress people with esoteric phraseology. And I used some examples in my lecture the other day of the fancy phraseology that the noisy negativists use, and it's funny. Because instead of investigating, they're proclaiming. You got to deal with the world as it is. And I put out, there's four basic rules for debunkers, those who practice debunkery. It's not my term, but I like it. One is, what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. Two, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up. Three, if you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's a lot easier. Those people are all kooks and quacks, and you know. And four, do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too darn much trouble. And I get people saying, well, how come there aren't any sightings by professional people? And I say, why do you say that? How much effort have you made to find them? All the surveys show that 5 to 10% of professional people have seen a UFO. That doesn't mean they're broadcasting it, which is another story, of course. Hard to get them to go on your show to talk about what they have seen. So I feel that there is no point in my being an apologist ufologist. Tell it like it is, and you'll get people's respect. And the big thing is you encourage people to open their minds and open their mouths, too. I check all my audiences at the end of my lecture. Typically 10% have seen one, but only 1% have reported what they have seen. Biggest reason, they're fearful of ridicule. I want to let them know it's okay. You don't need to worry about ridicule. If you stick to the facts, talk to the right people like me. I'm not going to laugh at anybody. And that's a big thing. But I personally believe if any major newspaper, doesn't have to be the Washington Post or New York Times, made a sincere effort to elicit reports of former military people that took place while they were in the military and said they'd protect witness identity and all this kind of thing, give them anonymity, whatever. And here's a number to call, a toll-free number, and here's an email address and whatever. I think they'd be swamped with reports. And I like military cases because guys on duty very rarely lie about their official activities. I'm not talking about drugs. I'm not talking about sex. I'm talking about what they're doing when they're monitoring a radar set or
something. I understand.
There's a difference.
And you got a point there.
Well, yeah, you talk to military people, and you got everything to lose. If the boss catches you lying about being on guard duty or that kind of stuff, you know, you're in trouble. And I find so many good reports. Because what I do is not only ask how many of you have seen one and then how many have reported it. Is anybody left? I'll ask how many of you were in the military at the time. If there's still anybody, I'll say you want to tell us about it. Then I get some great stories. For example, a guy says, they took my pictures. I'm waiting for the rest of the story, and he's sitting there in the audience. Not.
I'm waiting for that one, too.
Yeah, and so I say, look, you don't need to stand up. I'm not asking your name, but I'm sure everybody would like to hear about it. Everybody claps. So, reluctantly, well, I was flying a four-engine aircraft for the Air Force out over the Pacific. There was another plane 20 miles ahead of us. It radioed back that there was a saucer heading our way. We had gun cameras. We took pictures. We radioed the base we were going to. This is all standard operating procedure. When we landed, the film was taken. Pilots don't take film to the drugstore. It goes through the proper authorities. And we were debriefed and told never to say anything. I had another guy who told me, he said, I'll tell you privately. He was piloting a helicopter in Vietnam. Flying saucer zips around the helicopter, scares the bejeebers out of them because they thought it was a new Russian vehicle. It was back in the 60s, and they're going to be obliterated any moment now. You know, it's a very sleek kind of thing, comparison to a helicopter, almost anything is, I guess. And it went off, left them alone, so naturally he reported it. You're supposed to report any new technology in battle because everybody would like to know that there's a new weapon system there. And so the next day, the commander of the unit comes over and says, Lieutenant Jones, you didn't see anything strange yesterday, did you? Yes, sir, I reported it. You didn't hear me, Lieutenant Jones. You didn't see anything strange yesterday. Well, do you like flying, Lieutenant Jones? Yes, sir. You didn't see anything strange yesterday, did you? No, sir. Well, you get enough variations on this theme and a picture begins to come out. So that's why I say appeal to the military people. And I'm still looking, well, I had two stories today here about possible witnesses about Roswell.
Still, even now, all this time later.
Even now, all this time later. Well, to illustrate why I'm an optimist about finding more, last week it was announced that the oldest surviving World War I veteran in Nova Scotia had died. He was 106 years old. World War I now. And there are still 10 left in the country of Canada out of 30 million people. So if we still have World War I veterans, which ended in 1918 after all, then probably there are still a lot of people around who know about 1947. You know, that's not too big a stretch. People are living longer these days. And I'm hoping that some of them will take the attitude that one of the important witnesses about Roswell was then-Colonel, later retired Brigadier General Thomas Jefferson Dubose. He was Chief of Staff to General Roger Ramey, who was head of the 8th Air Force in Fort Worth, Texas, and the 509th at Roswell, the military group there, reported to General Ramey. Now, he told me that he took the call from General Ramey's boss telling him three things, three orders. He said, I want you to get the press off our back today. This is July 8th, 1947. I don't care how you do it, but get them off our back. Two, I want you to send some of the wreckage that's due to be there shortly here with one of your colonel couriers today. General McMullen was in Washington. Dubose was in Fort Worth, Texas.
So you said a colonel as a courier.
Yeah, yeah. He wasn't playing games about this. And the third order was, I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order, colonel. Do I need to put it in writing? No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it. People sometimes look at me when I say that. I said, you know, this is right after World War II. You didn't question commands. You followed orders. That's the way things were.